All right. Good morning, everyone. How are you doing? Let's try that one more time. How's everybody doing? Yeah, a little bit better. All right. Hey, thank you very much. I know it's been a very busy week here at MMS, and I've been talking with lots of folks, whether it's been at the Server Aquarium. By the way, if you haven't had a chance to check out the Server Aquarium, if you haven't sat down and gone through a hands-on lab, please, highly recommend it. Don't miss one of the most valuable experiences at MMS, actually being able to go hands-on with all of System Center. It's really amazing. Server Aquarium is really also a fantastic state-of-the-art private cloud, and you can actually go and walk around and check out all the hardware, and there's guys there that can answer all the questions for you. Make sure you check that out. So it's been a very busy week. Today, this is WSB 355, Windows Server 2012 Private Cloud and Security. Certainly, I'll be touching on Hyper-V, but actually, I'm going to touch on a wide variety of topics. In Server 2012, we actually made a number of security enhancements across the board. And while we have been talking a lot about Hyper-V and talking a lot about storage and talking a lot about networking in Server 2012, we've also made significant changes in terms of security to help you out. And just want to make sure people are aware of some of these other features that are actually in there. So, a couple things I wanted to cover today. Talk about secure boot and early launch. Why are these features in there? What's the goal of these features? What's the thinking behind it? I want to answer one of the most common questions I get all the time about security. We're going to beat this one into the ground, into submission. Limiting a local admin. Not a week goes by where I don't get an email from someone in the field that says, hey, these people are local admins and we want to restrict them from doing X. So let's talk about exactly how you do that. BitLocker. Of course, the importance of BitLocker, we made some very significant changes with BitLocker, especially with Hyper-V in Server 2012, to actually help you protect your infrastructure and help protect against inadvertent data leakage. Very important one. DNSSEC. So a lot of people don't realize how important this capability is and don't realize how fundamentally insecure DNS is. We've actually put in DNS security built right into Server 2012. It's one of those things that probably hasn't been on a lot of people's radars, but it's very much baked into the platform. Dynamic access control gives you the ability to set policy to actually help you protect your data let you define policy and let the system protect your data. Fine-grained password control, we're going to spend just a moment talking about Java, and then certainly we're going to talk about Hyper-V security enhancements and kind of what the Hyper-V architecture looks like. One of the things, again, I want to beat into the ground is all these questions that I get asked all the time. Well, how do I know, you know, what's secure and what's isolated, and how does Hyper-V work? We'll talk about the architecture in depth and explain to you just how isolated and just how secure it is. So, one thing I want to point out is the Microsoft Security Intelligence Report. A lot of people don't know that we do this and that exists. It's a valuable ongoing report. We collect data from a variety of Microsoft locations, from our Malware Protection Center, our Security Response Center, our Engineering Center, and also our own Microsoft IT that manages our own global internal services. And we provide a regular ongoing security intelligence report, and it's available there. And an important data point I always like to point out is that less than 1% of vulnerability attacks are zero-day. I know they get the most press. I know those ones that the blog writers are writing about because it makes them really happy. It makes them feel super important. But less than 1% of them are zero-days. 99% of attacks have vulnerabilities that, guess what? Their update's already available. I'm going to use one that's actually really readily available. Maybe some of the older gentlemen and older folks in the room remember this. Remember this thing called SQL Slammer? Way back in the early parts of the 2000s, way back when? People don't realize the patch for that existed over 6 months before the actual hit went out. So it's really important. I'm glad that you're here, and I know that right before this session there was a big discussion about configuration manager, importance of patch management. Nothing changes when you move to private cloud. I'm going to be very transparent about this. I know that there's some virtualization folks out there that have long been saying that, hey, virtualization just makes everything magically better. Okay? Oh, everything's just magically performs better. Everything's just magically more secure, and everything's just No. Common sense still applies. Good system administration, good system admin hygiene still applies. Okay? So we're going to talk about that. Secure boot and early launch anti-malware. So what are the current issues with OS boot, and what are we addressing in 2012? So Maybe you remember a few years back, back in the mid-2000s, there was a lot of talk about this thing called blue pill. And everyone was worried that, oh, this is gonna be the end of hypervisors, and this is gonna be the death of hypervisors, because this blue pill thing is this magical piece of code that gets below the hypervisor, and can lie to the hypervisor, and then, you know, we can take over your whole systems and you can't even tell. That's nice in theory, except it's nearly impossible to implement, if not impossible to implement. And the reason why is quite simply, there's a zillion different ways that I can tell that there's a hypervisor running. Very often someone will send me an email and say, hey, Jeff, I can detect that I'm running in Hyper-V. Sure you can. There's at least a dozen different ways you can do it. Easiest way is actually go check the motherboard in the virtual machine, and it says, lo and behold, Microsoft. Okay? Pretty simple. But the point is, the bad guys are trying to get earlier in the boot process. Now, that's something that can't be ignored. And we don't. We look at all those trends, and we look at where the bad guys are going, and it's certainly something they're trying to do. It's to get earlier in the boot process. So we're seeing a growing class of malware targeting the boot path. And often the fix is you got to go reinstall the OS. Okay? That's not something anybody wants to do. So the whole point of UEFI and secure boot is the hardened boot process. So all firmware and software in the boot process is signed by a trusted certificate authority. It's required for Windows 8 client. It does not require a TPM, and it reduces the likelihood of bootkits, rootkits, ransomware, etc. Because we are attesting, we are measuring the boot process itself, and we can ensure that nothing has gotten into the boot process itself. In terms of that, we also want to couple that with early launch anti-malware. So secure boot is only one part of the path. The other part is actually making sure that only known digital signed anti-malware can load after secure boot. So if you've got AV software, you want to make sure that you boot, you've got measured boot, you've got attested boot, you've gone all the way through the boot process, and before you hand it off, if there's an AV vendor, you want to hand it right to the AV vendor after you've done all that attestation. That's when you want to do it. And so it works in conjunction with secure boot. It doesn't require it, because if antivirus vendors want to plug in and not use secure boot and on legacy systems, then we want to give them that option to load as early as possible as well and still protect older legacy systems. But on newer UEFI systems, newer systems that secure boot, we want to protect as much of the boot process as possible, and this gives us a way to do that in a great consistent way. And the whole point is, it's about preventing malicious software from loading before legitimate programs and anything that could potentially lie to the OS or anti-malware software. This becomes extremely important as we start to move to, of course, deploying more and more on standardized cloud infrastructure, and the bad guys are trying to figure out, how do I get in, how do I create the perfect way to get in as early as possible? If I can figure that out and I can replicate that as much as I can into an infrastructure, I can get my hands on the crown jewels. So we're looking at all areas. We never rest on our laurels when it comes to security. We continue to push the state of the art. Secure boot and early launch anti-malware is just a couple of examples. So limiting a local admin. Like I said before, not a week goes by where I don't get some question from the field that says this. Jeff, how can I prevent a local admin from formatting a disk, changing the size of the page file, reading events in the event log, changing screen resolutions, installing applications, accessing a USB disk, enabling a feature or role, creating and deleting VM, viewing a Hyper-V VM, changing the desktop background, changing NIC settings, adding new networks? You're trying to prevent a local admin from doing something local on the system. By definition, a local admin has the ability to do anything on the system. That applies to anything in Windows. Please, listen to me carefully. If they're a local admin, you have given them the keys to the Maserati. Okay? They've already sped off. There's no ifs, ands, no buts. You think you can write little scripts and cute little things that, oh, after they log in, I'll run and some actions and limit them? No, they're an admin. They can go undo all of that thing you just did. If you want to limit someone's functionality, don't make them admin. If you don't trust your admin, you have bigger problems. Rinse and repeat. Okay? There's no magic bullet. There's no secret sauce. Let me give you a real-world analogy to hammer this home even further. So, you're leaving town for a month, and you decide to give a neighbor a complete set of keys to your home. You ask your neighbor to bring in the mail and feed your prize goldfish Fluffy. You lock all your doors. You lock all your windows. You lock the garage. You even lock your bedroom door and you hide your expensive gear, your laptops, your tablets, out of plain sight as an additional precaution. So, Fluffy's safe, right? Of course not. No. You gave your neighbor the master keys to your home. It doesn't matter that the front door is locked. It doesn't matter that the garage is locked. It doesn't matter that you hid the items. This person is already in the house. Your neighbor can, A, be a really awesome neighbor. Check out Fluffy. Make sure he's fed well. Even keep an extra eye on your house to make sure nothing happens while you're gone. Great. Or invite friends over to your house for a party. As long as they clean up afterwards, you're none the wiser. Or what happens if the neighbor is visiting Fluffy and decides to open the window for some fresh air and forgets to close the window? Someone breaks in and steals Fluffy. All of these are possible. Okay? It all comes down to intent. Well, I gave him the keys. After that, who knows what's going to happen? So that's a very real-world analogy, but I hope I really kind of nailed this one home. You have a local admin. They can do whatever they want. Don't make them admin. BitLocker. So one of the things that's really powerful is the fact that BitLocker can help a variety of different scenarios. One of the reports that came out a few years ago talked about the billion-dollar and the billion-euro laptop problem. So back in 2010, they did a company did some research with 275 organizations in Europe, and they found out that over 72,000 laptops were lost. That's a staggering number. Well, they went out and they said, "Look, how much did that really cost, though?" 1.79 billion euros. Now, the cost wasn't the laptop. Laptop was actually the cheapest thing in the entire equation. It was the data. It was the liability. It was the fact that many of these people can and did get sued because guess what? There was proprietary, personal, regulated data that should not have been on those that got lost. So it's actually the hardware is the least amount of least cost of it. It's the data itself and the legal exposure. We also did the same thing back in 2010 in the U.S. They surveyed 329 organizations. 86,000 laptops were lost at $2.1 billion. Same exact thing. They said, look, the laptops, the hardware itself, was really a rounding error compared to the legal costs of losing all of this. So we looked at this and we said, we really want to help solve this problem. BitLocker is something we've included in Windows Client and Windows Server now for many years. On the server side, we want to protect against inadvertent data leakage. Now, what I mean by that is exactly this type of example. Last year, HIPAA had a scenario where a large medical provider in Tennessee is paying $1.5 million to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And it's because they had 57 hard drives stolen that contained protected health information for over a million individuals. Think about what's your most sensitive, most important, most private data. That's it. Your health history, your health records. Imagine it if it was your children's health records. Just thinking that makes me angry. I've got two daughters, nothing would make me crazier if their health information was out there. Okay? So that's exactly what happened here. 57 hard drives that were stolen that contained over a million individuals' patients' health care. Now, they made the argument that, like, look, we shouldn't be actually fined anything because this was secured by security patrols. This was secured by a biometric scanner. This was secured by a key card scanner. This was secured by magnetic locks. This was secured by key locks. Why are we getting fined anything? You can see we've done our due diligence. The point was the data got out. We'd sue you. We'd actually fine you more if we could, was their answer. And one interesting statistic is 71% of healthcare organizations have suffered at least one data breach within the last year. That's a staggeringly high number. So we look at this and we want to really help solve this problem. We want to help secure the data itself. So that's why we're providing a critical safeguard for the cloud with encrypted cluster volumes through BitLocker. BitLocker is a capability we've had in Windows Server now, way back since Server 2008, 2008 R2. But back in 2008 and 2008 R2, it only works with local storage. So you'd have a server, and if it had spinning disks inside direct attached storage, that was fine. And in fact, our military uses BitLocker on their servers. When they go into other regions, they go into combat, guess what? Standard operating procedure is that you enable BitLocker on all the disks and you encrypt them. If you have to make a quick retreat, standard operating procedure is to put a grenade on the server and head that way. If the grenade takes out the server, fantastic. If the grenade doesn't take out the server, it doesn't matter because the disks were already BitLockered. So even if the bad guy pulls out the disk and actually get the entire disk out, puts it in another machine, you only have two options. You type in the PIN or you format the disk. That's it. So now what we're doing is we're bringing this to clusters. So now you can create the biggest, baddest clusters in the industry. 64 nodes, 8,000 VMs in a cluster, and now you can cluster the shared storage. This works with failover, with cluster shared volumes, and this takes advantage of a new cluster name object. So you do need to have a 2012 domain controller that actually does the network unlock and works with clustered volumes. That's actually a key important capability because the last thing you'd want is a server to fail over or a machine to fail over, and all of a sudden you got to go type in a PIN. So there's got to be a way that you can do this securely without an admin actually in front of the machine to type in a PIN like you would on a laptop. So this integrates with Active Directory, this integrates with group policy, it integrates with Hyper-V, and it integrates with failover clustering, all built into the box in Server 2012. And it's great for things like branch office deployments, or many cases, for example, the data center in a branch office is literally some system sitting under some guy's desk. So very good for those insecure environments. Volume level encryption for compliance. And the other important thing is a very negligible performance impact. You're not even going to feel it. We had to put in special instrumentation to even measure it. So prior to 2012, BitLocker required a TPM or an admin with a PIN or a password or an admin with a USB key. We can see for a server, especially in a clustered environment, that's not going to be a good thing. Because if a server, you know, if there's a power outage in the middle of the night and there are no, you know, admins there, everybody's at home sleeping, it means those servers are down waiting for someone to type in a PIN or to put in a USB key. Now we have network protector mode where it communicates securely with Active Directory and can reboot up those machines securely. And of course, Server 2012 also supports hardcore encrypted self-encrypting drives as well. So we're taking advantage of the latest advancements. We'll use AES and NI in the processor if the processor's got it. So, you know, i7 and all late generations processors have it built in. And we'll take advantage of self-encrypting drives itself. So again, this is all about protection. And again, it's about protecting the whoops moment when a disk gets out the side and an inadvertent data leakage. So DNS security extensions, DNSSEC. I've just been reading about people starting to realize how important this is because there's a lot more cyber activity going on, and some would even say that we're in cyber war right now. Some nations and some organizations, let's just say, seem to be doing some interesting things out there in the wide world of the Internet. And people are starting to take a look around and going, hold it, what do we need to be securing? And one of those is actually DNS itself. So first of all, what is DNSSEC and security extensions? It's designed to protect the Internet itself from certain attacks like DNS cache poisoning. And it's a set of extensions that provide origin authentication, data integrity, authenticated denial of service, and it requires that authoritative DNSs actually sign their responses. Without these DNS security extensions, it doesn't do any of this. It's been like this for a long time, and people have known this for a long time, and people have kind of been saying, we need to go solve this one, folks. Why are we deploying DNS without these things enabled? Why would we even be doing any of this without these on by default? So one thing, point out what DNSSEC doesn't do, doesn't provide confidentiality, doesn't protect against, you know, denial of service. That's not its goal, okay? It's very clear goals about what it does and what it doesn't do. So with 2012 DNSSEC, it requires that the authoritative DNS assign the responses. It was introduced in Server 2008 R2, but I'll be honest with you. What we had in 2008 R2 was pretty difficult to use. It could be a challenge, for example, especially interoperating with other non-Microsoft DNS solutions. Configuration was at the command prompt. Okay, so it was not the easiest thing in the world, no easy GUI, for example, and it required re-signing any time a record was updated. So yeah, it was in there. Yeah, we know people were deploying it. In fact, we were deploying it quite a bit, but we knew there were some serious challenges in making it really a great end-to-end solution. In Server 2012, we now support the latest RFCs. We support the latest crypto. It's integrated with Active Directory. That's a big, big, big win here, which means you get automated re-signing. So no more manual steps here in terms of re-signing anytime a record is updated. And it's GUI rich. So no command prompt. I don't need to go flailing around looking through the command prompt. It's actually GUI rich and it's very easy to use. So I urge you to take a look at that. So improving server management and security. One of the things that, you know, we introduced way back in Server 2008 was a different way to deploy Server. In Server 2008, we introduced something called Server Core. And so when you deployed the operating system, when you installed, you had your disk in hand and you go run setup, it would actually say at setup, do you want to install a Core OS installation or do you install a full GUI installation? Okay? And a full GUI would give you, just like you're used to seeing in the past, there's Shell, there's Explorer, there's everything you expect to do. And Core would give you just a command prompt. And so here it is. This is way back in, this is actually 2008 R2, but this also existed in 2008. And you can see there's an option. It says, do you want to do a full installation or do you want to do a Core installation? So there's the full GUI, familiar, and primarily for SMB. And there's Core. It's just the command prompt. You manage everything remotely. And the one of the things we're trying to really push way back when is ensuring proper server management, good server hygiene. I'll get to that in just a moment. And it reduces the attack surface. However, I will be the first to admit that in 2008, it was very difficult to manage. 2008 R2, we made some more improvements, but it was still could be very much a challenge to manage remotely. 2012, we made some major changes to how you can deploy server now. In fact, like I pointed out in 2008 and 2008 R2, it was when you installed the OS that you had to make the choice. And that was the only time you got asked. So during OS install, you're asked right at the front, core full. That's it. In 2012, it's now configurable. So you can start off with core, or you could start off with full, and then guess what? You can remove it. And in fact, we've even created a third, we've actually created a middle version as well. So you've got core, you've got full, and we've got this new middle thing. So you can see here, here's what setup looks like now in Server 2012. It says, note, and I even want to point out, we even recommend now, core is recommended. And you're going to see us push this harder and harder and harder. And the reason why is this. Servers, for the longest time, we've made them easy to use. We've made them readily available, but you manage the box. You actually go to the box and manage it. You know what we want to do? We want you to manage this remotely. We want you to treat those servers, install it with a core OS installation, and manage everything remotely. Because one of the biggest challenges we're seeing is, I'm going to say it, bad server hygiene. People browsing the web on servers. People running QuickBooks on domain controllers. That's not a joke, by the way. I've run into people that do that. People running things on servers that should not be running on servers. If you look at why there are security issues, it's because they're not following best practices. Okay? Do those things on your client box. Do it on your tablet. Do it on your laptop. Do it on your desktop. But your server should be running what that server is. So core is recommended. And if you still are saying, you know what, Jeff, I'm not totally comfortable with that, guess what you can do now? You can install the full GUI and remove the server graphical shell. So now, you can see here, I've even put it here in the screenshot. You can go here and say, let's just remove the graphical shell. You reboot the server, and guess what? GUI's gone. No IE, no shell, no nothing. I'm back to a command prompt. If you decide later, oh, you know what, I want to go back from core to full, you can go back and re-add it. I've also pointed out we've added a third option. This is actually one of my favorite options. This is the minimal server interface. So what you'll see here is this has the command prompt, it has PowerShell, and it has Server Manager. Now, it doesn't have the full-on shell, doesn't have Internet Explorer. That's everything it has. But for Server Manager, if you need to actually go to a machine and do some local administration of the machine itself, like I want to go here because I'm in a small environment. Say I've just got a couple servers in a retail office, for example, or a branch office. I've just got a couple of servers. Guess what? With Server Manager, just alone here, I can configure the system. I can enable NIC teaming. I can enable remote administration. I can do a whole bunch of things here right there in Server Manager, but I keep the attack surface down. And it also, again, it encourages me to not do things that I shouldn't be doing, like running IE or running applications. Okay? This is a command prompt and Server Manager, and of course, PowerShell. So keep that in mind as well. Dynamic access control. So one of the things that we did when we were developing Server 2012 is we spoke to a lot of people in a lot of different areas, all verticals, healthcare, financial, military, governments, security. We spoke to security auditors. And one of the interesting things that security auditors told us is that when they, security auditors, by the way, those are the guys who pay to go into your organization and take a look around. Look at your networking, look at your storage, look at what your admins do, look at what your processes are, go take a look at what ports are open, those type of things. And they basically said, you know, one of the things we see pretty much in every environment are file shares that are wide open. Okay? So an example is, hey, you know what, I got to give my boss an Excel spreadsheet. That Excel spreadsheet has a whole bunch of Visa credit card numbers in there, or Social Security numbers, or tax information. And you know what, she says, you know, I need it up I need to get it. It's pretty big, so stick it up on a file share. So I create a file share and stick it up there. Okay? Now, IT admins, you're doing your very best to provide drop boxes and lock down things and only, you know, limit the administration for your company in doing the right thing or using SharePoint, but that doesn't stop or get rid of the need for and the use of file servers out there. So there's a number of things we want to do to help protect this by adding intelligence to the system itself so that you can define policy and the system can help protect and encrypt these documents. First of all, documents can be automatically classified. Okay, so for example, by content, I could say, you know what, this format looks like Social Security number, okay, XXX-XXX-XXS. This format looks like a credit card number, okay, and then I could also provide Active Directory attributes. For example, perhaps medium or lower classified data can be viewed remotely, or high profile data can only be viewed while I'm on site and I'm domain joined. So maybe while I'm at home and I'm, you know, reviewing things remotely on my personal device, maybe I can see, you know, the medium or lower classified data, but the high classified data, I've got to be in the office on the domain using my corporate owned machine. So I can provide those types of policies, actually build that in there, and let the system do it itself. So dynamic access takes advantage of different types of objects, user, group, computer. Claims are something you either are. So, for example, I'm a Lenovo laptop, and this is my MAC address, or an attribute assigned to an object. So I'm a manager in the marketing group. Okay, so maybe a manager or a hire or a director of hire, I can provide that's a specific attribute, and I'm going to make that part of the policy that I define. That can be used for authentication and authorization. So now what you can do is you can put these things together for expression-based authentication. So, for example, via VPN, I'm a marketing manager in the marketing group, and I'm using this Lenovo laptop with this MAC address, and I can access the SharePoint side and medium classified data. Think about what types of policies and how powerful that is. Because as we start to move to this world where people are bringing in all sorts of random devices, one of the things that, you know, CTOs come into Microsoft and they're concerned about this proliferation of devices. Many of them, they're easy, they can control. Many of them they can run policy on. They're using Config Manager. We're seeing phones, we're seeing tablets, we're seeing devices that, what? You can flash your own ROM and put your own stuff on them. Do I really want those to be able to access all my high-profile data on my corporate network? I don't think so. So I do want to be able to provide policy to determine when and what devices you can access my corporate data with. So I can also say that locally on the domain, that same manager in the marketing group using this laptop, Lenovo laptop, with this MAC address, okay, you can access high classified data. That helps me protect my content, protect my core IP. Fine-grained password policy. So this is actually something you should really be thinking about. I'm kind of amazed that you know, how many people don't probably tune their password policies as well as they should. So think about this. Suppose you have an average user, just an average user in your infrastructure or in your company, and you're going to give them a 12-character password and it expires every 90 days. Okay, that's cool. Do I want my domain admins to have that same level of password policy? What about my service accounts? Is 12 characters enough? No, actually, I'd like to harden those further. My domain admins, the guys that have keys to all of the, you know, the keys to the Maserati, I'd want something more than that. So my domain admins, they require 16 characters, caps and other characters. In fact, they expire every 14 days. Okay? I want to make sure that, you know what, I'm going to put a little extra burden on them, but they have much more authority and the ability to do much more in my infrastructure, so I'm going to elevate that password policy for them. Finally, what about service accounts? Service accounts are those, you know, it's not a user logging in, but it's a service running. It needs permission. Well, that's something I want to give it a really long password. I want it 32 characters. It may not expire. Maybe it's an every 6 month expiration, but I'm going to give it something really difficult because this is something that's running my core infrastructure. So guess what we did in 2012? Well, back in 2003, by the way, password policy was set locally and at the domain level, just to remind you what it used to look like. In Server 2008, we introduced fine-grained password policy, but again, this is one of those cases where, yes, we introduced the engine, we introduced the plumbing, but to actually use it was PowerShell and some special AD editing tools. In 2012, it's this awesome, easy-to-use GUI. Take a look at this. So now, for example, you want to enforce a minimum password length, you want to enforce a password history, you want to apply it to people or groups in AD. All of this, of course, integrates with AD. Very easy to walk through the entire process. So now you can very easily define those policies, set those policies, whether it's, hey, my standard users, my domain admins, maybe my Exchange admins, they have a different level. My network admins, they have a different level. My infrastructure fabric managers, guys that are actually running my Hyper-V infrastructure, okay? Maybe I want to make sure they have a different policy. But of course, and again, my service accounts. So we've made this very easy to configure and use. And of course, all of this can be done remotely. So what I said just a few minutes ago about running Server Core and doing all this remotely, this is all can be done remotely while the servers are running Server Core. So Java. All right, I'm going to pretend for just a moment that I don't work for Microsoft. I'll get your question in just at the end. Hold on one sec. Look, I'm just going to present some facts, okay? I know there's it's a Microsoft guy talking about Java. Look, this is just the state of what's going on in the world. This is what everybody's out talking about, and I just want to present the facts. So understand what's going on right now. Java is like this. This is what's happening. This is what the US CERT says. This is the facts. And they've said, look, it doesn't matter what platform you're using. Don't get into the religious battle. This is not a platform thing. There's a fundamental problem here, and it affects all platforms. This is what's going on. This is from the US CERT. On top of that, it's some of the worst, most critical, I cannot state this loudly enough, the worst possible exploits known out there, bypassing the whole Java sandbox itself. Java is the world's biggest target for hackers. It's been the top exploit for many years. This didn't just crop up yesterday. I'm laughing at these people that said, oh yeah, this is new to me. I hadn't heard this before. Really? Where have you been? The other thing that's very concerning is these are remotely exploitable. These are the worst types. These are not the, hey, a guy snuck into your data center with a USB key and started doing stuff. No, huge percentage of these. In this last case, it was over 50% of them were remote code executable. So just want to let you know, keep in mind what the recommendations are. Again, this is industry-wide. This is forget that I'm wearing the Microsoft badge. Okay, this is what the Department of Homeland Security says, straight up. Okay, Charlie Miller. It's not like this just happened overnight. It's been insecure for years. This should not be a shock. This should not be news to anybody. Kaspersky, Java is responsible for half of all cyber attacks last year. Security blogger Roger Grimes, every company whose security I've audited has a Java problem. Full stop. It's an ongoing one that predates the current threat. It's a convenient attack vector for most of the malware arriving in companies. So I urge you to take a look. Again, this is an overall security talk. Take a look at where, why, and how you're deploying it internally. If you're deploying a new application that requires it, you should have a real serious question as to why. Why are you deploying this application? Does it really have to use it? That should actually be a criteria whether you should deploy that application in the first place. You're opening up a serious attack vector using this technology. You should also very much consider, if you are using it, lock this down as much as you humanly can. Okay? But Those are the recommendations from the folks out there in the security world. Let's talk about Hyper-V architecture itself. So, questions I get asked all the time. So let's talk about the assumptions, the goals, how we develop Hyper-V, our thinking, what the architecture looks like. So when it comes to Hyper-V, so first of all, let's start with Windows Server. Let me ferret out some misconceptions right off the bat. When you install Windows Server is a blank slate. Okay? It's a blank slate. It's waiting for you to determine what's the feature, what's the role of this server. Is this a file server? Is this a print server? Is this Active Directory? Is this ADFS? Is this a fax server? Is this Hyper-V? Okay, so the first thing you do when you install Windows Server is you install the role. Okay, install Hyper-V, great. There's not a zillion processes. Everyone looks at the disk footprint all the time. I get these weird emails talking to me about disk footprint. That is such garbage. Okay, we include zillions of drivers in Windows Server. We include lots of content. We make this thing available in 20 different languages. So yeah, the disk footprint's big because guess what? Way back in 1995 when we, for example, shipped NT and didn't include drivers, you had to go download a driver for every device on the planet. You like having the drivers in there. Trust me on this one. Don't get fixated on footprint. So we install the operating system. Again, it's a blank slate. Then you install Hyper-V. Once you install Hyper-V, we enable the hypervisor and we reboot the system. Once we reboot the system, the hypervisor is now running. Until you enable a Hyper-V role, you're running on the bare metal just like you always have. Once you enable Hyper-V, the hypervisor sits below everything, running on the bare metal. And in fact, once this is assuming I'm booting up for the very first time, the hypervisor sits directly on the bare metal. And in fact, we have what we call the parent partition. And then you have what we call children partition or virtual machines. All right? Now, the reason why the parent partition gets a special name is because it's a special partition. It's the only partition that gets to see all of the physical hardware. All right? All of the virtual machines, and I have one there, but I could have as many as my hardware will allow, all of those are completely isolated in every way, shape, or form. And I'll cover all that in excruciating detail. But the parent partition, that's just Windows Server. Okay? It's just Windows Server. Now, what runs in the parent partition? Well, we install some Hyper-V services. For example, we've got worker processes. So you'll notice that there's a number of worker processes. Well, for every virtual machine, there's a worker process. So if I've got 5 virtual machines, I've got 5 worker processes. 10 virtual machines, 10 worker processes. And basically, that manages some of the running state for the virtual machine itself. You'll notice that a whole bunch of this, by the way, is running up in user mode. And the reason why we do that is because you want to push as much as you can up into user mode. Okay? Because user mode, you're deprivileged. You can't do a lot of things that are critical to the system. So when you start up a virtual machine, we create a worker process. The WMI provider is how we can remotely manage Hyper-V. That's how System Center, for example, manages Hyper-V. That's how a variety of ways you can programmatically access Hyper-V. The VMMS service works in conjunction with the worker processes and communicating with the virtualization service provider. Now, down here, we've got kernel mode. It's the kernel. It's drivers. It's the super optimized device drivers that Windows has been shipping for 20-some-odd years. What's nice is this doesn't require a new driver model. We did this because that's what our hardware vendors like to do. They want to be able to take advantage of that. Take advantage of the fact that we have 20-plus years of optimizing, tuning, coding, and really giving us a fantastic performance experience. And I know the other guys have this goofy article claiming that they're faster because we do something called indirect I.O. This, honestly, is complete and total nonsense. If they're supposedly faster and if they're supposedly more direct, then why do we beat them in all the benchmarks? Why, when you go actually look at TPC, why are all the top 20 servers running Windows Server and not the other guys? It's all garbage, okay? When it comes to device drivers, we have 25 years in Windows and Windows Server tuning and optimizing. and providing a massive, massive parallel processing in terms of I/O. So when a virtual machine is started up, we've got guest applications, we've got virtualization service clients, we've got VM bus. So what happens is, actually I can use the pointer. Here we go. So what happens is, how does I/O work for a VM? So what, say, for example, I need to read a packet off the wire, all right? So what happens is a guest application will call down into the networking stack through the virtual machine. Okay, it'll call down here through the networking stack. That networking will actually be sent over VM bus. VM bus is a high-speed in-memory communication between the virtual machine and the parent partition. That network I/O goes to the virtual switch here, the VSP, and it determines, oh, does this need to go to a physical NIC? Great, let me give it access to the physical NIC. That's how I/O works. Works very optimally, works very tuned, and of course, all of this is completely secure. So let me explain what I mean by that. Let's talk about some of the security assumptions we made when we developed Hyper-V. Number one, we assume guests are untrusted. You can hope for the best case, but we assume the worst case. We assume that the bad guys are already in the virtual machine. And they know that they're in a virtual machine, and they realize, hey, I want to get out of this virtual machine. Okay? If you're running in a virtualization layer, you know you want to get out, and you want to try and get to the hypervisor, because that's where the crown jewels are. In terms of trust, the parent must trust the hypervisor, and the parent must be trusted by children. Okay? Because to do that, to install the hypervisor in the parent partition, and in fact, to install Windows, you had to be an admin in the first place. So it kind of makes sense. You had to be an admin. We assume that code in the virtual machines and in the guests can run in all available processor modes, rings, segments. There's no limitation. If we told people, hey, you can run any code you want except for this, well, that's where they'd go start right there. Okay? So there's no limitations what you want to do inside of a code running in a VM. Everything is documented. We're very open. We're very clear. We have our hypervisor specification. We have our hypercall API. We'll even tell you that we're running on the hypervisor. We'll even give you the version number. We don't pretend to even hide it. Like I mentioned earlier, there's a zillion different ways you can tell you're running in a hypervisor. And we understand that the internal design of the hypervisor is going to be well understood. We're not trying to hide anything from anyone. We also, of course, have to ensure strong isolation between each of the virtual machines. This is actually one of the goals for any hypervisor. You have to protect the confidentiality and integrity of each guest and the guest data. So, from a separation standpoint, this is where all the questions get lined up. So, Jeff, how do I know that there's nothing being shared? How do I know that my VMs are really safe? If I'm running in this VM and my competitor's running in this VM, how do I know they can't see any of my data? Real simple, because that's the core goal of what Hyper-V does. Number one, we provide unique hypervisor resource pools per guest. Every VM has its own instantiation, its own resource pools. There is no sharing at all, period. Okay? Each VM has its own memory, its own CPU, its own resources. Every VM has its own worker process. So as I mentioned before, up in the parent partition, each one of them has its own unique worker process. On top of that, and the fact that it's running up in user mode, we even deprivileged it further. So even if the bad guys figured out some way to get out of the worker process, which no one has, even if someone could figure that out, they have no rights to do anything on the system. So you just broke out of jail and you realize you're still in prison. Okay? Not going to help you. Guest to parent communications all happen over unique channels. So that VM bus thing I mentioned, that's how there's communication between the virtual machine and the parent. Very often someone will say, hold it, Jeff, does that VM bus, does that span all my virtual machines? If I have 10 VMs, are they all sharing the same VM bus? Can I put some sort of listener on VM bus? No. VM bus is a point-to-point communication. Every virtual machine communicates to the parent over its own unique VM bus channels. It is a point-to-point interface. So there is no possibility of doing a man-in-the-middle attack because there's no middle. Non-interference. This is another goal. Guests cannot affect the contents of other guests. Guest computations are protected from other guests. Guest-to-guest communications are not allowed through VM interfaces. By the way, if other VM vendors are doing this, shame on them. VM to VM communications without going through the parent, you've just created a separate back door that you as a system administrator have to go close now. We don't do that. We were very clear. In fact, this is something our system administrators have told us. They said, you know what, we like the fact that Hyper-V doesn't create any sort of separate secret back channel that I have to go lock down or have to manage or have to go operationalize. Everything, if you want to get files from a VM to another VM, you set up a network. You use authentication, you use ACLs, you use traditional networking. We don't create some super secret side channel that you got to figure out how to lock or how the bad guys are trying to get into. Memory, registers, caches are scrubbed on every context switch. So that's how crazy secure we go. When we're switching from running on one virtual machine to switching to another virtual machine, we have to scrub the processors themselves to make sure there's nothing left when we move to and start executing for the next virtual machine. And we are quite serious about isolation. There's no sharing of virtualized devices. So each virtual machine has its own virtual NICs, its own virtual SCSI controllers, its own IDE storage controllers, its own compute, its own memory. Each one of them is unique to every virtual machine. Separate VM bus, and there's no sharing. Each address, each VM has its own address space. And by the way, what about dynamic memory? Because dynamic memory is about pooling memory across the entire server and then allocating it to virtual machines on the fly as they need it. Well, of course, we zero out everything. That's actually a feature of Windows itself. So all of the memory is automatically zeroed before it's reallocated. So there's no chance of anything happening there. Again, VMs can't communicate with each other except through traditional networking, and guests can't perform DMA attacks because they're never actually assigned physical hardware. It's all virtualized hardware, so that's not even possible. Guests can't write to the hypervisor, and the parent partition cannot write to the hypervisor. So again, we've protected every individual component and compartment. This is what having a secure development lifecycle is all about. We've looked at every aspect of engineering each component and how they interact with the other ones and all of those interfaces between all of those blocks. So I get asked about Hyper-V hardening. So one of the things that before I even get to this is we ship secure by default. This is really an important premise for us. We take this as a core engineering tenet. And I'll show you this as I walk through some of our thinking for Hyper-V replica as we develop that feature. But we don't actually ship something and say, oh, by the way, this thing is insecure. Go twiddle these knobs. That's the wrong way to ship product. Hyper-V itself is already built using the latest state-of-the-art technologies when we build, we develop, and compile. We use ASLR, we use StackGuard cookies, we use NX execute disable, which are hardware protections that actually prevent executing code from pages where it can't or shouldn't be. We use guard pages, we use exception handling. The hypervisor itself is binary signed. So again, I cannot stress this enough. When we take security extremely seriously at every layer of the stack. And the hypervisor and the parent components, every part of Hyper-V, the hypervisor, the network stack, the worker processes, the storage devices, the integration service, every one of those is threat modeled, static analysis, fuzz testing, penetration testing, both by internal Microsoft folks as well as third parties. So we invite third parties to double check our work. We spend a lot of time doing this ourselves, and for every new feature that we develop, it has to have a threat model. It has to have static analysis. If it doesn't have it, doesn't ship. We'll get it the next time around. But it has to have all these as a minimum. I certainly can't say this about the other virtualization vendors out there, because I don't even know what their security development lifecycle is, because they don't even publish this information. We're very clear about this. We're very transparent about this. This is how we do business. Protecting the parent. Like I mentioned before, use Server Core. You certainly can use the full version. You can certainly check out the new minimal server interface. But if you say, Jeff, what is the absolute best way to deploy it? I'm going to tell you, it's to use Server Core. All right? Manage it all remotely. Less code, less third-party code. But for me, it's about less temptation to install other applications and workloads. I was sitting with a system administrator a few months back, and he said, oh, I don't worry about this because I only use Chrome on my servers. And I just wanted to cry. I'm like, you're so missing the point here. You're so missing the point. You shouldn't be browsing the web on a server in the first place. If you've ever tried to run IE on server, you'll notice the thing is locked down. You can barely do anything. We've made it really painful to use on purpose. And even throughout all of that, you're still wanting to browse the web. Please, manage your servers remotely. Keep the parent for Hyper-V only. Install the Hyper-V role, install failover clustering. That's all you run in the parent partition. That's it. Don't run a domain controller. Don't run SQL. Don't run Exchange. Don't run other workloads. Don't run anything in the parent. The parent partition you should think of is it does two things. Two things. Number one is the I/O. As I mentioned, networking I/O, storage I/O, that's all processed through the parent partition. Okay? That's the first thing it does. The second thing is that's where the management agents go. So if you're using remote management, so System Center, you've got the management agents, those are going to live there. If you're in a small and medium environment and you're actually managing on the box with Hyper-V Manager, that's fine. You can do that. But don't run other workloads in the parent partition. That's not what it's designed to do. And by the way, we have a free Hyper-V product called Microsoft Hyper-V Server 2012. You should absolutely consider this. This is a product that, honestly, we don't market. Okay? The marketing guys won't market because it's free. But it's the real deal. It's the full deal. It's not a trial version. It's not a limited version. It's not a brain-dead version. It's the full Hyper-V. Live migration, storage migration, shared nothing live migration, 64 virtual processors, Hyper-V replica, NIC teaming, storage, spaces. It's all in there in the free product. And bonus, the only way it deploys is with the minimal interface. Okay? One of the reasons I really like Hyper-V Server is because there isn't a GUI on it. You can't run IE on this. It's not there. There is no shell. That's what Hyper-V Server looks like. It's just the command line. The whole point of Hyper-V Server is real simple. You install it. You download the DVD for free. You burn the DVD. You install it. And then you basically configure the machine. You name it. You join the domain, and you manage it remotely. And let me be very clear, you need to run this in a domain. Okay? Don't try and run this without a domain. It's going to be just too painful because from a security perspective, it's so locked down. Okay? That's for your own good. You're going to want a domain controller. But once you do that, you can now manage this remotely. You can manage it remotely with System Center. You can manage it remotely with the Hyper-V Manager, which is our free management tools. And again, it helps encourage remote administration. So take a look at that. Patching, simple, obvious, important. There's no shortcuts. Microsoft provides numerous options. You can use Windows Update, built into the platform. You can use Windows Server Update Services, also built into Windows Server. Or you can use System Center Configuration Manager. We've given you three different ways to do this. Okay? By the way, there's no such thing as perfect code. Every platform, every application, every product needs to be patched. Okay? The point is, we've got to make it easier. We've got to make it better. We've got to make it faster. And that's what we've done in Server 2012. We have cluster-aware updating, for example. With Server 2012, I can literally have it automatically patch every cluster node in my infrastructure automatically, hands-off. I could set up a 64-node cluster and say, you know what, every Friday, last Friday of the month, go ahead and patch every node for me and do it automatically. Okay? Every product needs to be patched. So have a patching strategy. Keep the parent in a domain. Kerberos is simply much more secure than NTLM, and that's what you get when you're in a domain. Delegate administration. So that parent partition that I talked about, the admin of that parent partition, like I mentioned earlier, is the local admin. They can do whatever they want. However, you don't have to be a complete local admin to do Hyper-V. You can delegate administration. This can be done with the inbox tools or with SCVMM. By the way, in Server 2012, we made this easier. If, for example, you're in a branch office and you've got just a couple servers and you're managing these locally, guess what we did? Look what we added to computer management. There's actually a new Hyper-V administrators grouping here. So if I'm the local admin and I want to let Bob just create VMs on my system, on the system, but I don't want to give him full admin access, just add him to the Hyper-V administrators group. So now he can create VMs, and that's all he can do. He can't play around with the rest of the system. So we made this really easy, even if you're just using the inbox, a simple deployment. To add a delegated administrator in System Center Virtual Machine Manager, there it is. There are all the steps there. And this is a very common question. Hey, Jeff, I'm in a large environment. We've got a couple of Uber administrators, but we also have some departmental administrators, and we'd like to give them the ability to give them their sets of VMs. Marketing has a marketing admin VM, or maybe I've got some storage or some marketing or web or file or print, but each one of them has their own administrator, and I want to delegate that without giving them the ability to manage everything in my virtualization farm. All right there in System Center Virtual Machine Manager. So it gives you flexible delegation. Antivirus. Question I get asked all the time. Jeff, do I need to run Hyper-V at the parent partition? Do I have to run antivirus? The answer for me is, well, actually, if you follow our best practices, you don't need to do it. If you follow our best practices, which is run server core, don't install anything else in the parent partition other than management agents, you don't need to do it. You really don't, because there's nothing else running there. The problem is, unfortunately, getting people to that state. Okay. So the other thing is, it may not be a technical question. Very often someone says to me, Jeff, I'm in an environment and I have to check this checkbox that says I'm using antivirus. Otherwise, I can't deploy it, because that's what our company policy is. If you want to run antivirus, then go right ahead. You can check the checkbox. You can install antivirus in the parent partition. If and when you do, make sure you read that KB article. It tells you what files should be excluded from the AV scan. Okay. So yes, you can do it if you want. If you follow our best practices, you really don't need to. I don't run any AV on any of my servers. Of course, I'm in a non-production environment. But you don't really have to if you follow our best practices. But if you do, again, for compliance reasons, or just because it's going to make you feel better, then go right ahead. Just make sure you follow that KB. Security Compliance Manager. Security Compliance Manager is something I want to make sure people realize has been out there for quite a while. This is a great tool that's freely available. Let me say that one more time. Freely available. Integrates with System Center. Allows you to import, take advantage of existing group policy, to create snapshots, to reference machines, configure standalone machines, provides updated security guidance, centralized management of your baseline portfolio, allows you to scan your infrastructure and figure out, hey, am I making some mistakes that the Security Compliance Manager can help me solve? Am I really following all of those best practices? We make it real easy for you. So this is a tool that's been available through many versions, and now we have a new version for Windows Server 2012. And it's available right down there. So you guys will have access to the slides, and you can click right there on the link. What about protecting the virtual machines? So as we move to, you know, a world where we have this demarcation between the physical infrastructure down here and my virtual machines on here, we've talked a lot about down here, but what about in the VMs themselves? What should I be doing to protect those? Well, the virtual machine files and VMs are files. They're protected by ACLs, access control lists. So by default, this is all secured. Every file is going to be secured with ACLs. And there's a number of different files that make up a VM. The XML file is the configuration file. VSV is a save state. VHD and VHDXs are the virtual disks themselves. And the ACLs are created by Hyper-V when you create the VM, and we assign those. But user ACLs are also used. But again, it's best when used with delegated administration. So if I give Bob his set of VMs and I give Mark his set of VMs, when Mark creates his VMs are all ACLed for Mark. Okay, so that was automatically done, because I get asked this question all the time. Is there something that I need to do to help protect that my VMs that, you know, Mark and Bob created actually stay separate even if they get moved around? Well, when they're created, Hyper-V is doing the right things when it comes to ACLs. And if you'd like to change and modify those ACLs further, you can. But by default, you don't need to do anything. In fact, in 99% of the cases, you really don't need to do anything. It's all there. But the important thing is that it plugs right into ACLs and just how we manage security through the file system. And by the way, in case you want to do file auditing, this is a question I get asked. So for example, I'm in a highly regulated environment. For compliance reasons, I need to be able to audit file accesses. I need to be able to say who did what at what time. Is there a way I can enable the file auditing? Absolutely. And here's all of the steps to do it, to enable auditing for a file or a folder. So you can do this, and you can determine who's been accessing virtual machines, and who's been accessing. And of course, this applies to any file or folder. It doesn't have to be Hyper-V. So protecting the guest OS itself. So remember, guest operating systems are just like physical computers. The OS, in most cases, doesn't even, you know, if you're running an older OS, doesn't even know it's running in a hypervisor. Our newer operating systems, 2008, 2008 R2, Windows 7, Vista, 2012, Windows 8, they all know running when they're running in Hyper-V. But still, you have to treat them, you have to protect them just like physical computers. So number one, just like I said on the parent and in the physical, you have to keep your guests up to date. You got to patch them. Understand that patching story. The other thing you have to remember is it's not just patching the OS, it's about apps. And I know that's something we've been talking about a lot this week at MMS, is looking at the security attack surface. Folks, the bad guys have stopped looking in Windows for the most part. They're all looking at all the common apps out there. Okay? In fact, we're saying more than 50% of the new exploits are all being done on apps that you're installing in the OS, because those are a much easier target for them. So you've got to look at those as well. Is it iTunes? Is it Acrobat? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So make sure you're thinking about how you're patching that. And of course, make sure you patch the OSs through the tools we provide as well. From a networking standpoint, I want to point out that we made some really great enhancements to the extensible switch in Server 2012, and a bunch of these reasons were for security. So if you look at Server 2012, one of the things we have is the ability to plug into the switch itself. One of the things that people want to be able to do is to be able to inspect packets or to do intrusion detection. So for example, if I want to just monitor packets as they go across the switch, we've got S-Flow by Inmon. That's available today. Plugs right into the switch and allows you to just watch packets as they go across. If I'm interested in anti-malware, firewall integration, intrusion detection, IPS, IPF, all built right into here, guess what? We've got the Windows filtering platform. In fact, 5.9 has been building on this, and I'll have something on this further in just a second. But this gives you the ability to insert packets, drop packets, filter packets, just go crazy. This is the perfect place for security vendors to plug right in into the Hyper-V 2012 extensible switch. And then finally, we have forwarding extensions. So for example, if you do want to use the Cisco Nexus 1000V, Cisco made some pretty awesome announcements yesterday, by the way, in case you didn't hear. They're plugging in. They've got plugins that are going right into System Center Virtual Machine Manager for their UCS systems, and the Nexus 1000V is on the way. Well, the Nexus 1000V plugs right here into the forwarding extensions. By the way, NEC has already released the programmable OpenFlow switch for Hyper-V's extensible switch. And by the way, this was the first platform they targeted. It's only available on Hyper-V. And we've got more that are plugging into the Hyper-V extensible switch. In fact, our door is kind of getting knocked down by people saying, we're going to go plug into this because this is awesome and extensible. Also, what's nice about this is you can use these in tandem. So for example, if I want to use, say, the S-Flow with the Cisco, I can actually use them in tandem together. That's something you can't do with the other guys, because this was designed and architected to be pluggable. So 5.9 just announced this morning the 5.9 Security Manager plugin for SCVMM. What's cool about this is it allows, it's a module designed to plug into the 5.9 Security Manager firewall product that they've released to market. It allows you to set firewall traffic rules. It allows you to set and remove monitoring from VMs. It allows you to run anti-malware scanning processes. And it allows you to log records in the Virtual Machine Manager console. So here's a couple of screenshots from it. You can see it's integrating right in the System Center Virtual Machine Manager console. So if you want to set your global manager rules, you want to set your firewall settings, your AV settings for anti-malware and scanning, it integrates right into VMM. And this is all plugging into the extensible switch. Configure rules. So for example, if I want to configure IP rules, ARP rules, broadcast rules, you can see just how easy it is to do that. And they include a variety of templates as well. So here's an inbound rule, and here's a number of templates. So for example, here's AOL Instant Messenger, DCP, Daytime, DNS, Discard, etc. There's a whole bunch of built-in templates that you can use in their virtual firewall. So this is in the release candidate stage. We're really excited about the work that Five9's been doing, taking full advantage of what the extensible switch has to offer in 2012. And in case you're wondering, a deeper dive on the virtual switch, as well as how to write NDIS filter drivers in the filtering platform, is all available as well. Now, another thing that's important from a security standpoint I wanted to really highlight is this middle option here that we include in the built-in switch itself. So not only did we make the Windows Server 2012 switch extensible, but we added a whole bunch of awesome capability right into the built-in switch. Okay? You don't have to simply install Hyper-V and go out and buy something extra, because we actually put a whole bunch of really cool things in the box, like quality of service, for example, and a whole bunch of port mirroring things for debugging and security. Well, one thing I really wanted to point out is this middle one, which is IPsec task offload. This is actually really important as we see more and more people looking to encryption on the wire. And they want to be able to do that end-to-end encryption. And what's nice about it is you don't have to modify your applications. It's completely transparent. Well, as things start to move around in this cloud world, sure, maybe my workload is running here, you know, in my data center, or maybe it's running in my data center a couple blocks away, or maybe it's running in a different data center somewhere in the cloud. I don't even know where it's running. But I want to make sure that end-to-end is completely encrypted. Now, in Windows Server 2008 R2, Hyper-V, and earlier, we could do encryption and decryption, but it would have to happen inside the VM. So you could run IPsec, but there's all that work is actually happening. Computations are going on within the VM. So it would add some usage to the CPU side within the VM. Well, a couple percentage points isn't a big deal, but if you're running, you know, 10, 20, 50, 100 of these, it's going to start to impact your overall system as you're doing all this encryption and decryption. So on Server 2012, we now take advantage of IPsec task offload. So if your NIC supports the ability to do the encryption and decryption in the hardware itself, we transparently take advantage of that capability. So if it supports it, we do all the encryption and decryption in the hardware. If it doesn't support it, then we'll fall back to software the way we've always done it. It's on by default, so you don't need to, you know, because we want to make sure it's secure by default. We want you to be able to take advantage of this capability. So that's a really nice new security feature built right into the switch in Server 2012. Another security feature we built in is DHCP guard, router guard, and the monitor port. So one thing I like to remind everyone is, look, the bad guys, they have access to credit cards too. There's no reason why they can't go up onto a cloud and say, hey, you know what, I'm going to pretend to be a DHCP server, or I'm going to pretend to be a router, because I want to try and see if I can actually find and snoop packets from somebody else, some other tenant on the infrastructure. We want to help protect against that. The other nice thing about the DHCP guard is, hey, how many times have you had someone accidentally set up a DHCP server internally in your company, and you're spending, you know, some time running around the office trying to figure out who's screwing up the system? Well, with DHCP guard, you simply check the checkbox, okay? And basically, if someone created a VM that's running a DHCP server, we don't let it send out those DHCP advertisements. So we prevent that from happening right there at the virtual switch level. Same thing is true of the router guard. Router guard prevents against router advertisements being sent from the switch, and so that's another way to help protect your infrastructure. Key cool capability, all about security built in. Finally, monitor mode. So monitor mode here allows you to be able to inspect packets. Now, there's a bunch of reasons why you want to do this. Certainly, if you're trying to debug performance issues is one reason, but another one would be, hey, I'm actually going to do some packet inspection. I actually want to see what's going across, perhaps for security reasons. So you can set a destination and you can set a source, and you can actually monitor packets as they go across the switchboard. Also, network bandwidth and QoS. There's actually a security element to this. Think about it. If you've got a whole bunch of virtual machines on a server, certainly you want to use quality of service, because you want to say, you know, my SQL server is really important. I want to ensure it has the network bandwidth it requires, and I want to meet that service level agreement. But the important thing is it also can be used by an untrusted user to actually try and consume all of the network bandwidth on the system and actually do a denial of service. So what you can use is actually set the minimums and maximums and enforce those, and it'll prevent a single VM from taking up all of the bandwidth and saturating it from a specific VM. So do you trust your VMs? Like I said, we certainly don't. The easiest way for VM is to attack the parent is over the network. So create separate virtual networks for different security levels. If you've got some special workloads that are running on their own high security, something that's extremely, you know, a different level of network security. For example, if you would have different security fabrics in your physical world, then you should be doing that for your virtual world as well. So create different separate virtual networks and put those VMs on different separate virtual networks as well. Like I mentioned before, virtual machines can try to soak up resources to do a denial of service. If you're worried about that, if you're an enterprise, you may not be too concerned about that. But if you're in a host environment, you may want to cap the CPU. You may want to cap the memory, cap networking, and monitor your VHD disk usage. So things to keep in mind to prevent soaking up resources. So lastly, one of the things I wanted to talk about was how we develop new features in terms of security. So as we walk through the process of creating a new app, a capability or technology, what's the thinking that we do when we develop a feature? And how does the things that we've learned through the secure development lifecycle influence how a feature is actually deployed? So let me give you an example, Hyper-V Replica. Hyper-V Replica, brand new feature, just released in Server 2012, and a lot of people simply love this feature. Well, we just released this feature in 2012, and one of the things I want to point out is, what was the thinking that went behind how we went and implemented it, and the defaults, for example? So when you install and enable Hyper-V Replica, you notice the first thing we do is we make you choose the authentication type. Is this Kerberos? Is this HTTP? Is this HTTPS? Are you using certificate? By default, we give you the most secure thing. Okay, by default, oh, got to use Kerberos. And if you want to use certificate, it's completely grayed out until you provide the certificate. So we don't even let you get into a bad state in the first place. That's the thinking of secure by default. Next, it's also off by default. When we enable new capabilities and new features, very often, we make you go turn it on. We want you to be proactive about enabling the feature. We don't want to have this thing on and it's something you have to go manage. That's why when we ship Server 2012 and you deploy it, it's actually a blank slate. It doesn't come with web services enabled. It doesn't come with Hyper-V enabled. It doesn't come with file and print enabled. We want you to make the conscious decision of what's the choice. That is what secure by default means. So, Replica is disabled by default. Replica requires an admin to enable the feature. Okay, we want to make sure the right person gets to enable this feature because we're talking about sensitive data that is being replicated. We use Kerberos by default, and you'll even note that in the UI, we clearly tell you that the data isn't encrypted if you're using that mechanism. If you're using certificates, then it is. So we're always very transparent about what these features mean and the security implications, even of a simple checkbox. So even after you enable Replica, the default settings are the most secure. So number one, we actually allow you a number of different ways to do replication. We could say, you know, we'll allow you to replicate from any server, or we can specify specific incoming servers that we allow to. By default, we choose the most restrictive, the most secure. We allow replication from specified servers. If you want to open up wider, absolutely, you can go right ahead. That's your choice. That's why we gave the feature and enabled to you. But by default, you've got to choose those specified servers. If you choose to use certificate-based authentication, you must select a certificate. In fact, we won't even let you leave the dialog. If I select use certificate-based authentication and I don't provide a certificate, I won't even let you leave the dialog until you provide a certificate, because you can get yourself in a very bad place from a security perspective. So the way to get out of it without doing a certificate is to uncheck the checkbox. Okay? It's being very heavy-handed about security because we need to be. It's about protecting your data. And in fact, that's what happens right there. If you try and leave that dialog, you check, use a certificate, but don't provide a certificate, there's the error you get. You didn't give me one. You need to give me one. Common criteria. Another question I get asked about. Jeff, I'm looking about this for military. I'm looking about this for government usage. And I need to make sure it's common criteria certified. Every single version of Hyper-V has had common criteria certification all the way back to 2008. 2012, common criteria certification is currently underway. And just to let you know, it takes a while. Okay? And we cannot even certify until the bits go final. We can't give them betas. We can certainly tell them what we're doing and review them and give them a heads up as to what's coming before, but they can't actually start looking at the code until we give them the final bits. So 2012 common criteria is underway. So a couple of takeaways. Number one, Hyper-V is designed to minimize the attack surface of the virtual environment. The hypervisor itself, all of the virtual machines, all of the resources, everything that makes up all of the components of Hyper-V are completely isolated. The hypervisor itself
is isolated to a microkernel. It's independent of third-party drivers. In fact, I should point out the hypervisor at the very, very bottom of the stack that I pointed out in one of the early slides. When somebody usually asks me, who has access to that code? The answer is no one, only Microsoft. There are no third-party drivers. There's no third-party code. It is all Microsoft code written 100% by Microsoft developers. The parent partition itself, it's a virtual machine. Like I said, it's a special one because it can see all of the physical devices in the machine, all the device drivers. It knows that, oh, I have a fiber channel physical HBA, I've got an Intel NIC, I've got this type of processor, et cetera, et cetera. But it's still a virtual machine. Server core, great option for host computers. And, of course, use VMM for delegation, providing security protection with role-based security and authorization. Apply standard policies to both computers and VMs. Again, good server hygiene. Make sure you've got a patching strategy in place. Make sure you've got operations management in place. Make sure you're running security compliance, both on the parent as well as in physical machines, as well as in virtual machines. Why wouldn't you use this tool everywhere? It's one of the reasons why we give it to you. So please take good advantage of that. Define networks or VLANs to isolate to provide networking traffic. Or you can take advantage of the new network virtualization, where we logically segment there as well. Leverage firewalls and intrusion detection, antivirus. Take a look at the 5.9 virtual firewall. Thing is really cool, very easy to use, very easy to configure. You can go up to the 5.9 site, and I believe you can still download the pre-release bits. Again, consider using IPsec. Consider using end-to-end encryption on the wire. By the way, I get asked about Hyper-V live migration. Can I encrypt that traffic? You absolutely can if you want, but most of the time you're going to be doing live migration between servers, probably within a rack or within a couple of racks. So it will impact performance because encryption will do that. But if you really want to do it, you can absolutely do it. You've been able to do it since day one. It's totally supported. Most people tend to not do it because usually they can actually see where it's on a private network for live migration. But it's absolutely there and supported. Again, only add, don't forget to harden the OS using security compliance toolkits. So like the security compliance manager will help you go through and make sure that you're actually following our best practices there. Install the latest integration services. Do not give VM administrators permission to the entire OS. Okay, it's why we added that new Hyper-V administrators on the local machine, or if using System Center Virtual Machine Manager, delegate that access to your administrators. Be very careful about who you're giving full domain access, full Hyper-V infrastructure access. So again, there are no security shortcuts. We designed Hyper-V, we designed Windows Server from day one to be secure by default, and apply standard policies to both hosts and guests. So with that, I want to say thank you very, very much. I'll be here to answer any questions afterwards. I hope you enjoy the rest of the time here at MMS. And again, don't forget to check out the Server Aquarium and the hands-on labs. Thank you very much.